Listening to a class session of the course entitled Pietism and Evangelicalism. The subject of this week is the rise and characteristics of the early English evangelical. According to our syllabus outline for the seventh week, the material for study is focused on 1, political factors in the rise of evangelicalism. These factors are the reign of Queen Anne, 1702 to 1714. B, the accession of the House of Hanover in 1714. The rule of the Whigs, with England's first Prime Minister, Sir Robert Walpole. C, the political relations in the Walpole period with the establishment. 2, the socio-economic factors at the time of the rise of evangelicalism. The factors including A, tycoon and tradesman, B, peasant and pauper, C, philosophy and publication, D, crime and correction. Religious background factors, number 3, at the time of the rise of evangelicalism. These deal specifically with A, Queen Anne and the church, B, the Hanoverians and the church, C, Archbishop Tillotson, reason and religiosity. 4, additional religious factors, the religion of deism, B, the clergy and preferment in the English church, C, dissent and religion, D, religiosity of the common people. And then 5, men and movements in religion, antecedent and more proximate in the rise of evangelicalism. These include A, Puritanism, B, Pietism and Moravianism, C, the Welsh revival effort, D, William Law, E, the Holy Club, F, Lady Huntingdon and her circle, and G, the religious society. And now we have the detail on the above 5 classification. Political factors, then, in the rise of evangelicalism. Queen Anne, last of the Stuarts, was the sister of the wife of William of Orange. Chief event of her reign was the union of England and Scotland, which made Anne the first to bear the title of ruler of Great Britain. During her reign, the so-called Succession War was fought, France giving up to England nearly all of her northern possessions in America, the War of the Spanish Succession. Peace was concluded in part by the influence of the Tories, who hated General Marlborough, a Whig. More directly bearing on the evangelical movement was the accession of the House of Hanover with George I, who reigned rather than ruled from 1714 to 1727. With the first George came the Whigs, and they stayed in control until 1760. Some 70 landed families controlled Whig power. Significant for the period of the first George is the South Sea Bubble affair and the promotion given to Sir Robert Walpole for his handling of the bubble chaos. With Walpole came government with minister responsibilities. And since Anne's time, no English monarch has ever vetoed a measure passed by the Parliament. Though not properly a part of the political scene, Walpole's relation to the establishment should be recognized at this point. In a word, it can be said that Walpole adopted a policy of putting a stop to all religious activity. And now, with reference to the detail on number two, the socio-economic factor, as a background for English evangelicalism. Here, the situation was a dual one, wealth and poverty, squalid housing on the one hand and luxury on the other. The situation in the industrial cities was little worse than in rural areas, for here, too, there was revolution. New methods, new livestock growth, but the enclosures of farms did real damage to the lesser tenants. They were faced with a choice of three courses: emigration to America, a factory worker, or village laborer. Many drowned their sorrows in gin. A quote from the period: "All I know is that I had a cow, and an act of Parliament has taken it from me." We think, of course, of Goldsmith's classic line: "Ill fares the land, to hastening ills a prey, where wealth accumulates and men decay. Princes and lords may flourish or may fade, a breath can make them, or a breath has made. But a bold peasantry, their country's pride, when once destroyed, can never be supplied." Another evil of this period was the penalty matter. Some 200 crimes were punished by death, and it took a long time to effect remedial legislation. The 18th century was also an age of thought, the age of the social philosopher. It was the era of the coffee house and, of course, the tavern. In its philosophical expression, the period emphasized compromise, dissipated royalists, and the rule of the saints gave way to good-natured compromise. From Handel's Il Moderato of 1740, these words are significant: "Kindly teach, how blessed are they who nature's equal rule obey, who safely steer two rocks between, and prudent keep the golden mean." It was the age of Swift, Addison, Steele, Defoe, and Pope. Locke died in 1704. Key words to an understanding of Locke are probability, reasonable, and compromise. Man was the subject. "Know then thyself, presume not God to scan. The proper study of mankind is man." Religious factors in the background of evangelicalism: Queen Anne and the Church. Though not a strong monarch, Queen Anne did much to activate the religious life. The two oldest church societies for spreading Christian knowledge at home and abroad were a part of the Queen Anne picture. The apathy so often associated with the 18th century before the evangelical revival set in with the Georgian era is characteristic. There are a number of causes for this, not the least of which was the policy of Sir Robert Walpole, who discouraged religious activity. The rather compromising position of Archbishop Tillotson is another. He wanted to bring all dissenters except Unitarians into the establishment, and his hatred of Roman Catholicism is a part of the background picture for our movement. For Tillotson held that in all matters of religion, there must be an appeal to reason. This was distasteful to most evangelicals. It might be added that Tillotson was for theology what Locke was for philosophy. other religious background factors in evangelicalism. Deism. The deadening effect of deism may be briefly illustrated by a remark of Wesley. He claims that on a tour in 1753, he found an innkeeper who drinks and laughs and argues into deism all the plowmen and dairymen he can light on. But no mob rises against him. And the reason? Good. Satan is not divided against himself. In your Bettinson, you find a very brief but concise picture of deistic principles. Another factor, the clergy and preferment. Much odium has attached to the English clergy of the establishment. It seems that we so often imagine them to be self-seeking and slick prelates who are constantly on the lookout for advancement. They called it preferment or preferments. Here is the response of a learned man to my query. What is your first reaction when you hear the term Anglican prelate? Quote, I think of a man in knee breeches, not necessarily corpulent, theologically broad. And this is not an imaginative statement that I have given you, but is the exact quotation from a conversation with one of the prominent members of our faculty staff. Now, this description would have fitted many clergymen of the establishment, but by no means all. Some 500 of these sleek and preferment-seeking prelates were on the roster of the evangelical movement. There are many references to the English clergy in literature and writings of the period. Quote, the general body of the clergy have been, and I am afraid always will be, very intent upon pushing their temporal fortune. This from Bishop Hurd. It may well have been true that few black-robed parsons could ever hope to become lawny bishops. Everything depended on influence. The poet Cooper's statement is witty and, in a large measure, correct. The parson knows enough who knows a duke. And other religious background factors I have labeled descent and religion. Strangely enough, at the time of the evangelical movement, the religion of dissent was at a low ebb. That it was so is indicated by Grimshaw and Wesley. The cause of the decline may well have been in the cessation of persecution. Mosheim's ecclesiastical history has this to say to the point. Those who are best acquainted with the state of the English nation tell us that the dissenting interest declines from day to day, and that the cause of nonconformity owes this gradual decay in a great measure to the lenity and moderation that are practiced by the rulers of the established church. In the famous work by Eliot Bintz, the situation with dissent is treated at length, and also contains a section on Unitarianism, a movement strong in dissent. With respect to religion of the common people as background for the evangelical movement. In concluding another section of our story of the rise and characteristics of the early English evangelicals, a brief word is said about religion among the common people. And among them we find yearnings very similar to those noted by the common folk in Roman Catholicism in the 13th century. The yearning was for something much more immediately usable than was offered by the subtleties of theology. Certainly, the general pattern of religion in England in the 18th century did not satisfy the yearning of the commonalty. Eliot Binns, to quote him again, puts it this way: "The type of Christianity current in the early years of the 18th century, owing to its favorless conception of religion, its intellectual and rational outlook, its prudential system of ethics, and its suspicion of anything which aroused the emotions and affections, could provide no sufficient satisfaction for the needs of the human soul." Another factor, men and movements in religion, antecedent and more proximate in the rise of evangelicalism. There are 8 factors listed in this category. Many more might have been added, but these 8 seem to be the significant ones. Evangelicalism is credited with reviving the spirit of Puritanism. Though there are marks of similarity between Puritanism and Evangelicalism, there appear to be strong dissimilarities. But to be sure, if a serious concern for divine approval was a characteristic of Puritanism, that trait is strongly articulate in Evangelicalism. Puritanism is an ancient strain in the English people and has such widely separated representatives as Piers the Plowman and John Bunyan. It is an interesting observation that Puritan literature was more popular with the establishment than it was with dissent. Pietism reached evangelicalism in England through the Moravians. Wesley spent some time at Herrnhut, was much impressed with the prevailing tone, and had close connection with Baylor and Zinzendorf, though the relations with Zinzendorf were later broken off by Wesley. The very first signs of the great 18th century revival were noted in Wales, and Howell Harris, who itinerated long before Wesley. Harris had gone to Oxford intending to be ordained, but was so shocked by the immoralities he found there that he left the university after one term. Probably one of the most influential precursors of evangelicalism was William Law, non-juror and author of 2 significant works, Christian Perfection and Serious Call to a Devout and Holy Life. All of the evangelicals read Law. And of Methodism, it was said that William Law was its founder and Count Zinzendorf rocked the cradle. Methodist historians Coke and Moore wrote of Law, "By his excellent pen, Law was the great forerunner of the revival which followed, and did more to promote it, perhaps, than the rest of the nation collectively taken." Law's main contribution was that, quote, "he set before men a forgotten ideal of the Christian life." Another movement, or more correctly, another factor in the rise of evangelicalism, was the so-called Holy Club at Oxford in 1729. Sometimes the Holy Club is considered to have been the beginning of the evangelical movement. This was a sort of collegia for Bible study and a great deal of active pastoral field work. The members were Oxford University students. One of them, a Mr. Morgan, died as a result of too much jail visiting and other types of field work. There is extant some correspondence between Mr. Morgan's father and John Wesley relative to the exhaustion and death of young Morgan. The name Methodist had been applied to the Holy Club in derision. One of the most active and influential leaders of the evangelical revival was Lady Huntingdon. Active as administrator and leader, she appointed men of the movement to serve in her chapel and did much to get them positions in the establishment. She made her greatest contribution among members of her own class. Wesley was happy about this, that through Lady Huntington, a few of the rich and noble are called. Eliot Binns, in his great work, devotes a long treatment to this unusual woman. Another of the religious factors in the rise of evangelicalism was the early influence of Charles Wesley. He has been credited with originating the Holy Club meetings, which were later taken over by John Wesley, who of course far surpassed Charles in organizational ability. Important for the evangelical movement also are the so-called religious societies. Though a similar pattern had been set by Pietism, these religious societies in the English scene were in a sense unique. They were societies of atheists, deists, and so forth. And the religious societies were to counteract these efforts. Out of these societies grew the so-called lectureships. Lectureships served as preparation for Holy Communion and to help worshipers remain faithful to their confirmation vow. Much of the preaching of Whitfield and the Wesleys was done in these societies. It was at one of these society meetings on May 24, 1738, that John Wesley felt his heart strangely warmed. The lectureship seemed to have been founded and supported by the religious society. Thus we have here, in a rather rapid survey, the chief background factors which we see in the great 18th century English religious resurgence known generally by the name of Anglican evangelicalism. Last session of the course entitled Pietism and Evangelicalism with Professor Phil J. Schrader, and various portions of the lecture will be presented by members of the class. And now, as to the work in hand. Yesterday, in our lecture, we spoke on factors that were in the background of the great English religious resurgence movement known as evangelicalism. Today, I should like to point to a book which carries in very wonderful detail and in illustrations as well a great part of the story of England in the 18th century. This is Life's Picture History of Western Man. A great portion of the book is devoted to the Industrial Revolution, the Agricultural Revolution, and also to thought in the 18th century period. So we highly recommend for your study Life's Picture History of Western Man. And now, continuing with our session's work, we give you a distribution for the 8th week of the course, which carries the story of representative men in this evangelical or English religious resurgence movement in the 18th century. There are three classifications. In the first lecture, we wish to point to the following men: James Hervey, William Grimshaw,
and Samuel Walker. Then, in the second lecture of the new unit, the early evangelicals of the establishment, number two, including particularly such men as Thomas Adam and the Reverend William Romaine. In the third lecture for this week, we have the Wesley Whitfield group and the evangelicals of dissent. Mr. David Oswald, our deacon, will now distribute the material for the eighth week. And while this distribution of this material is going on, we are going to hear from Mr. Helmke from the book referred to at the last lecture by William Law, the famous non-juror, who is often credited with being an important background factor in the rise of English evangelicalism. Mr. Law was read by all of the evangelicals. He tried to bring back to a decadent church the ideal Christian life, not only among the commonalty, but also among the clergy. And Mr. Helmke of our class will now read a portion of a book by Law, Serious Call to a Devout and Holy Life. And the selection he is going to read is on a clergyman of the establishment, or the English church, to whom Mr. Law has given the name Cognatus. This is a criticism of what Law thought was the trouble with many of the English prelates. Mr. Helmke.
Cognatus is a sober, regular clergyman of good repute in the world and well esteemed in his parish. All his parishioners say he is an honest man and very notable at making a bargain. The farmers listen to him with great attention when he talks of the properest time of selling corn. He has been for 20 years a diligent observer of markets and has raised a considerable fortune by good management. Cognatus is very orthodox and full of esteem for our English liturgy. And if he has not prayers on Wednesdays and Fridays, it is because his predecessor had not used the parish to any such custom. As we cannot serve both his living himself, so he makes it a matter of conscience to keep a sober curate upon one of them, whom he hires to take care of all the souls in the parish at as cheap a rate as a sober man can be procured. Cognatus has been very prosperous all his time, but still he has had the uneasiness and vexations that they have who are steeped in worldly business. Taxes, losses, crosses, bad mortgages, bad tenants, and the hardness of the times are frequent subjects of his conversation. And a good or bad season has a great effect upon his spirit. Cognatus has no other end in growing rich but that he might leave a considerable fortune to a niece, whom he has politely educated in expensive finery by what he has saved out of the tithes of two living. The neighbors look upon Cognatus as a happy clergyman, because they see him, as they call it, in good circumstances. And some of them intend to dedicate their own sons to the church, because they see how well it has succeeded with Cognatus, whose father was but an ordinary man. But now if Cognatus, when he first entered into holy orders, had perceived how rich by the gospel, if he had proposed to himself the example of some primitive father, if he had had the piety of the great Saint Austin in his eye, who durst not enrich any of his relations out of the revenue of the church, if instead of 20 years cared to lay up the treasures upon earth, he had distributed the income of every year in the most Christian acts of charity and compassion, if instead of tempting his niece to be proud and providing her with such ornaments as the apostle forbids, he had clothed, comforted, and assisted numbers of widows, orphans, and distressed, who were all to appear for him at least at the last day, if instead of the cares and anxiety of bad bonds, troublesome mortgages, and ill bargains, he had had the constant comfort of knowing that his treasure was securely laid up where neither moth corrupteth nor thieves break through and steal. Could it with any reason be said that he had mistaken the spirit and dignity of his order, or lessened any of that happiness which is to be found in his sacred employment? If instead of rejoicing in the happiness of a second living, he had thought it as unbecoming the office of a clergyman to traffic for gain in holy things as to open a shop, if he had thought it better to recommend some honest labor to his niece than to support her idleness by the labors of a curate, better that she should want fine clothes and a rich husband than that cures of husbands should be farmed about and brother clergymen not suffered to live by those altars at which they serve. If this had been the spirit of Cognatus, could it with any reason be said that these rules of religion, this strictness of piety, had robbed Cognatus of any real happiness? Could it be said that a life thus governed by the spirit of the gospel must be dull and melancholy if compared with that of raising a fortune for a niece?
Thank you very much. Now in continuing, I should like to clear up a number of terms that we will meet in our study of the evangelical movement in England. The first term that I have here is non-juror. We will hear that repeatedly. William Law was a non-juror. That means one who would not give his oath of allegiance to the government of William and Mary, because he felt that the succession in the dynasty had been ruthlessly interfered with. There were many of these clergymen who would not take the oath to the new house, and so many of them were bereft of position. The term dissent, of course, refers to all non-Anglican religious sects or movement. Does not refer, however, to Roman Catholics in England, of which there were quite a number. When we hear the word establishment, we are reminded that it refers to the Church of England, the established church. Perhaps seldom in the writings do we run into the term Church of England or Anglican Church, but rather the term establishment. Another word with which we meet in our study of the evangelical movement is the word living. And living, of course, refers to a parish or parishes. We say a certain man had a living up in Northumbria or in Cornwall, and means simply what we would today designate a parish. Curate comes from a word, of course, meaning care. And the reference is, in curate, to the care of souls. The word was often applied to young men who worked under a regular pastor. John Wesley's father had curates. These people, perhaps we could compare them with our vicars today, had abominable living, low salaries, and were fit generally to marry only a woman of a maid status. So we remember then these terms, non-juror, dissent, establishment, living, and curate. One of the first of the representative men of the English evangelical movement was a member of the establishment, James Hervey, who lived a short life between 1714 and 1768. He has been called an evangelical of the evangelical. This is manifest, perhaps, in his partisanship toward Methodism, though he was opposed to itinerancy. Itinerancy is another term with which to become familiar, and certainly in the English context, had reference to traveling about, particularly going into other men's parishes. Wesley, John Wesley, that is, was especially guilty of this practice. And he justified it by saying that the pastor, even a man of the state stature of the then, were not too well informed in dealing with the real needs of the people, of their parishes. Some neglected sick visiting altogether, and therefore it was incumbent upon a man like Wesley to disregard parish limits and go into other men's parishes. Though James Hervey was a great friend of Wesley, he was opposed to this itinerancy idea. He is famous for two works, Chiron and Aspasio, for one, and Meditations and Contemplations. In the first work, we have a popular exposition of Calvinism. Hervey was the college pupil and spiritual son of John Wesley. He devoted a large proportion of his income to Christian charity and benevolence. He died a comparatively young man. We shall hear just a portion from his work, Meditation and Contemplation. This little selection is from his Meditations among the Tombs. He had been walking around in a cemetery and has penned for us his reflection going among these tombs. This book, we often wonder why, did actually sell in tremendous numbers. It was a type of literature that much of England read. What is all the world to these poor, breathless beings? What are their pleasures? A bubble broken. What their honor? A dream that is forgotten. What the sum total of their enjoyments below? Once perhaps it appeared to inexperience and fond desire something considerable. But now death has measured it with his life and weighed it in his scale. What is the upshot? Alas, it is shorter than a span, lighter than the dancing spark, and driven away like the dissolving smoke. Indulge, my soul, a serious pause. Recollect all the gay things that were wont to dazzle thy eyes and inveigle thy affections. Here, examine those baits of sense. Here, form an estimate of their real value. Suppose thyself first among the favorites of fortune, who revel in the lap of pleasure, who shine in the robes of honor, and swim in tides of inexhausted riches. Yet how soon would the passing bell proclaim thy exit? And when once that iron call has summoned thee to thy future reckoning, where would all these gratifications be? At that period, how will all the pageantry of the most affluent, splendid, or luxurious circumstances vanish into empty air? And is this a happiness so passionately to be coveted? I thank you, the relic of founding titles and magnificent names. You have taught me more of the littleness of the world than all the volumes of my library. Your nobility arrayed in a winding sheet, your grandeur moldering in an urn. They are the most indisputable proof of the nothingness of created things. Never surely did Providence write this important point in such legible characters as in the address of my lord, or on the corpse of his grace. Let others, if they please, pay their obsequious court to your wealthy son, and ignobly fawn or anxiously sue for preferment. My thoughts shall often resort in pensive contemplation to the sepulchres of their sires, and learn from their sleeping dust to moderate my expectations from mortals, to stand disengaged from every undue attachment to the little interest of time, to get above the delusive amusements of honor, the gaudy tinsels of wealth, and all the empty shadows of a perishing world. We now have a brief look at Mr. Hervey as recorded for us in a book on the evangelical movement by an author named G.R. Delane. Mr. McLean of the class will read this brief section from Balaam on James Hervey.
The first evangelical parish in the Midlands was the village of Weston Favell, 2 miles from Northampton, where James Hervey was living his quiet, blameless life. He had been one of the Oxford Methodists and a pupil of John Wesley, and he was filled heart and soul with his old friends in their work. He did not itinerate. His health and his views of church order had made that impossible. Except for a brief curacy at Spiderford, he hardly ever stirred beyond the borders of his parish. He had lived there as a boy. He returned in 1743 to be his father's curate, and he succeeded his father as rector in 1752, and there he died in 1758. But he did much to help the movement with his pen. His first book, entitled Meditations Among the Tombs of 1746, ran through 20 editions in a very few years. And his next work, Theron and Aspasio of 1755, was almost as popular. Their success is incredible to a modern reader. Two friends talk endless theological platitudes in the most bombastic language, while, quote, cauliflowers sheltered their gay complexions under a green umbrella, and daisies were gay with the smile of youth and fair as the virgin snows, unquote. But the book certainly appealed to polite circles in the 18th century. Even the critical monthly review saw nothing ridiculous in them. And since it is the aim of a band of missionaries to speak all the dialects of the country in which they work, it was well that there should be one among the evangelicals who was able to translate his message into the jargon of the genteel world.
Thank you, Mr. Swain. Now, before going to the other representative man of the early evangelical movement, I should like to call attention to a few terms that are sometimes confused or even misunderstood. Most of the evangelicals, of course, were members of the establishment. But it is also true that the people called Methodists were of the establishment. John Wesley never really left the Church of England. And all through his life, he tried to prevail upon his itinerating preachers that they were not to lead their people away from the establishment, but they were simply to instruct them in private meetings or classes and to lead them to a higher type of Christian life. And the Methodists were sometimes called evangelicals. In fact, they are a part of the evangelical movement. Up to the 19th century, the names were really used interchangeably, Methodism and evangelicalism. Perhaps a word should be said about their theology. Perhaps we can say that most of the evangelicals who came or who stayed in the establishment, later Methodists of course did not, they were Calvinists, moderate Calvinists, rather than rigid Calvinists. There were a few of the rigid type also. But those people who are called Methodists were not Calvinists, strictly speaking, or we might designate them Arminians. Calvinist. For Wesley himself, was for a long time closely identified with the Arminian magazine, and makes no bones about it that his theology was Arminian. So then, the people called Methodists, who later separated from the Church of England, were Arminian in their theology. The evangelicals who remained with the establishment generally adopted a moderate Calvinism. They did not fully accept the decrees. The people called Methodists generally rejected the decrees. So we have Arminian, Calvinist, and moderate Calvinist in this movement. The dissenters, and I'm thinking of men like Watt and Doddridge and others, were also generally Calvinian in their theology. The next man then in our roster of early evangelicals, William Grimshaw, lived from 1708 to 1763. He was a curate at Haworth, became a fervent missionary. He welcomed Methodists and evangelicals to his pulpit. He actually engaged in itinerant preaching, was a strong Calvinist, but not unsympathetic to Arminians. Studied at Cambridge, was very indifferent in his youth, and at first limited his work largely to the Sunday services. We have a quote that you will hear again. He refrained as much as possible from gross swearing, unless in suitable company. And when he got drunk, would take care to sleep it out before he came home. The loss of his first wife and suicide of a parishioner did much, very much, to bring about a change in William Grimshaw. And serious Bible study brought on a conversion in 1742, and he moved to Haworth. Eliot Binns, in his great work, The Early Anglican Evangelicals, gives a large treatment to William Grimshaw. At this point, we should like to hear again from Balaine, the great authoritative writer on the evangelical movement, a short thumbnail sketch of this very, very famous churchman. And we are asking Mr. Lewis of the class to read this portion on William Grimshaw of Haworth.
Evangelicalism established itself in the North comparatively early. Its home was Haworth, a lean gray village on the top of the desolate moors, cut off from the rest of civilization by miles of rolling heather. The Haworths were, in latter days, the Brontes dreamed and died. It was one of the loneliest spots in England, but it held a man whose influence was felt through all the surroundings of country. William Grimshaw, in his younger days, was a typical parson of the period. He read prayers and a sermon once every Sunday. He refrained as much as possible from gross swearing unless in suitable company, when he got drunk, would take care to sleep it off before he came home. He was a huntsman, a fisherman, a first-rate card player, anything but a herald of the cross. Gradually, however,
a great change come over his life. We need not trace the process. Parishioners questioned about their souls, which he could not answer, his wife's death, a copy of Owen on Justification picked up in a friend's library, all played their part. And by the time he came to Haworth in 1742, his old energies were directed into new channels. He was a mighty hunter still, but a hunter of souls. He found a hard task waiting for him there. At the best of the times, the West Riding character is by no means easy to mold. The thick feud and slow of speech and sullenly suspicious of a stranger, gruff and stubborn and hating restraint, his little flock greeted with their favorite motto, "Keep thy sound to thyself." Moreover, in that parish, there were particular difficulties. For 3 years, the place had been without a clergyman, and before that there had been a scandal, which even in those days ended with his predecessor being suspended from the ministry. The village seemed to have lapsed into open heathenism. Every funeral had its arvel, which was a drunken orgy, and there were no religious rites when the body was laid in the grave. Sunday was market day in Bradford, and those who did not go to market played football on the board. The only element of religion in most of the people's lives was an ever-pleasant fear of Bergus, the awful phantom dog, who prowled in the night across the heather and who had propitiated by many curious rites. But the Haworth folk soon found that the new parson they had a brawny, as fearless, as strong-willed as themselves. He let them know that the Sunday football matches must be stopped, and the most reckless lad in the village dared not disobey. He let them know that he expected to see them all in church, and somehow or other, when Sunday came, very few were absent. Let us watch him as he conducts the service. Reality is the keynote of his character. Nothing merely formal or conventional is tolerated for the moment. Moreover, he realizes that the people before him are mere babes in religion. Before the prayers, his eyes sweep the whole congregation, and woe to the man who is lounging forward, but not on his knees. He is promptly rebuked by name. When he has satisfied himself that all are reverently kneeling, he begins to pray, and all contemporary authorities agree to hear him as an experience never to be forgotten. He was like a man with his feet on the earth and his soul in heaven. He would take hold of the very horns of the altar, which he would not let go till God had given him the blessing, or listen to him as he reads the lessons, translating a very difficult sentence into the broadcast Yorkshire and interspersing many homey comments of his own. The hymn before the sermon at Haworth is always a long one. Sometimes they even have the 119th psalm, for at this point of the service, Grimshaw was busy elsewhere. He takes his stout riding crop down to the vestry hall and marches out of the church. It is his custom, wrote John Newton, whose letters give the best picture of his friend's life, to leave the church while a psalm before the sermon was singing, to see if there were any idling their time in the churchyard, the street, or in the alehouses, and many of those whom he found he would drive into church before him. A friend of mine passing a public house on the Lord's Day saw several persons jumping out the windows and over a wall. He feared the house was on fire, but upon inquiring what was the cause of the commotion, he was told that they saw the parson coming. They were more afraid of the parson than of the justice of the peace. His reproof was so authoritative and yet so mild and friendly that the stoutest sinner could not stand before him. At last, when the customers of the Black Bull were safely inside the fold, Grimshaw ascends the three-decker and takes his stand beneath the text. "I determine to know anything among you men save Jesus Christ and him crucified." Hot and strong the sermon comes, and hail with uncompromising dogma, yet full of racy thrust and the quiet, dry humor which the Yorkshireman appreciates. His boast was that he always used to preach in market language, and sometimes his unconventionality offended his closest friends. But John Newton defends him. Frequently a sentence which a delicate hearer might deem vulgar conveyed an important truth to the ear and fixed it on the memory for years. "I give you my judgment in this point," something in his own way, that is the best cat which catches the most mice. Many of the leaders of the revival, Whitfield and the two Wesleys, Vane and Romaine, preached from his pulpit at one time or other. But from all, he exacted the same intense directness. On one occasion, Whitfield began his suave, conciliatory way with a few remarks about the privileges they enjoyed in Haworth, but Grimshaw sprang to his feet at once in the writing desk and cried, "For God's sake, do not so speak. I pray you, do not flatter them. The greater part of them are going to hell with their eyes open." Many and various were the texts he devised for instructing his people. Excuses from non-churchgoers were utterly useless with him. Some pleaded their shabby clothes. For them, he started a special service every Sunday evening. Others said that it was too far for them to walk. He promptly began barn services in four outlying hamlets. The first evangelicals always laid great stress on early rising. To them, it was a necessary part of a methodical Christian life. No one who had learned the value of time could possibly lie in bed after the sun was up, and daily service at 5 a.m. soon became the regular thing in many of their parishes. Grimshaw.